God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Nahum chapter 1, where we are ready to resume with verse 4. All right, the coin of the realm in which you and I live is time. Therefore, we are exhorted to redeem the time because the days are evil, and the only way to do that is to walk in fellowship. As the believer walks in fellowship, the imputed righteousness which God has provided at salvation becomes phase two righteousness as he obeys the precepts of doctrine and fulfills the righteousness that is required in the law. And so that is why God has provided a supernatural system whereby we can be restored to fellowship immediately. So we can walk in fellowship, so we can redeem the time by thinking, saying, and doing the proper things at the proper moment. God has provided sufficient grace so that we can, even in spite of our failures, continue to advance spiritually and achieve a level of acceptability that is called blameless in the scriptures. This does not mean sinlessness. This simply means a level of acceptable function before God in which even the believer who fails can attain to. So it's time to make sure you are in fellowship. It's time to make sure the STA is put aside, recognizing that the Holy Spirit is the ultimate teacher of the truth, and therefore one must be rightly related to him in order to fully comprehend, understand, and then to apply the truth. So it's time to deal with that issue and anything else you need to do so that you can focus your attention, concentrate, and profit from the teaching. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity we have once again to assemble together with the other saints to consider the eternal things of your plan, the principles that you have established by which your plan operates and by which it will be brought to its perfect conclusion. We thank you for the fact that your plan is continuing to advance in spite of human evil, in spite of human failure, that you remain above all of that and ultimately will fulfill the destiny which you have determined for this world. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are dealing here with the introduction, somewhat introductory comments with respect to the nature of God, with respect, as we're going to see now, to his great power, dealing with the moral issues first in verses 2 and 3, that we have seen that God has a moral nature that demands that righteousness be rewarded and that sin be punished. And so he is this way all the time, again, seeing the constant use of the participle throughout this section, both in terms of substantival participles functioning as nouns, but and also in terms of the way the verbal forms are used. That this is not an isolated incident with God. This is the nature of how he is all the time. That God is constantly angry with the wicked. He will never acquit the guilty, absolutely never ever will. And so he begins to manifest his anger, as we use that anthropopathism, ascribing to God, again, human emotion that he does not possess, as he manifests his anger against the guilty or the wicked, depending upon what you supply there in verse 3. Through the metaphor, as we see here, the figure in verse 3 of an approaching storm. And at the approach of the storm, then God is seen leaping into action. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. Cal active participle, again, you see the participle usage here, stressing the ongoing nature of the fact that God does this as a regular feature of his essence. The verb is not air, N-A, apostrophe A-R, means to reprove or rebuke. It indicates a check of some sort applied to a person or into whole groups through various strong admonitions or actions. And here, as he rebukes the sea, he puts a check to it. It goes that far and no further. And that is essentially what Nahum is saying here in these figures, is that there comes a point with the wicked, with the evil, when they have done enough, that God puts a check to it and says, this far and no further. So he rebukes the sea and makes it dry. Literally, he gives a rebuke, or he is rebuking with the sea or against the sea. The inseparable preposition bait here is probably used in an adversative sense, against the definite article plus the word yam, the Hebrew term for sea. And he dries up all the rivers, not translated here. They just translate it sort of as the semicolon. You have the wow consecutive with the PL imperfect, with the third masculine singular suffix of Yavesh. Y-A-V-H-E-S-H. That means to cause to become dry, hence to dry out. And here he uses a finite form of the verb, rebuking the sea. But he will, and again, the imperfect here would probably be seen in a continual sense, much like the participle before it. But again, this is the nature of language. Language is fluid. You can't become rigidly literal in your translations, or you're going to miss some of the nuances on the nature of how you deal with the categorization, say, of certain verbs, certain verbal forms, the imperfect and the perfect in the Hebrew. He dries up all the rivers, masculine, singular, noun, construct of coal, all, and then the definite article plus, what do you got here, nahar, rivers, the plural, and that word means exactly that, rivers. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The verb, as it typically does in the Hebrew sentence structure, comes before the subject. So you got the hifil, perfect third masculine singular of this word, karet. Karet, I'm sorry, C-H-A-R-E-B-H. Karet, that means to dry up, to make void of water or vegetation. So he dries up all the rivers. He causes to become the sea, he dries up. He makes it dry. Then he dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. Is the pu'al, the pu'lal, which is actually just a different stem because of the nature of the verbal stem in the cal. It's equivalent to the pu'al, which is the intensive passive of amal, A-M-A-L. Again, because it is intensive, this describes a state of total exhaustion. It's typically used after the judgment of God has fallen. And so these are figures for the judgment of God falling. Upon the natural realm. And if he can judge the natural realm, as he's going to get to in verse 5, and then at the end of that, the world and all the inhabitants in it, who can stand before his indignation, then man has to recognize that if God has the power to overrule the physical aspects of nature, that he can certainly check mankind. So they wither here, are become exhausted. The proper name here, Bashan, spelled exactly like that in the Hebrew, B-A-S-H-A-N. It's a geographic area. It's a region that's located north of Jerusalem and east of the Jordan. And there's a map, if you look in your notes, in the next page or two. I can't remember what page it's on. Page 9, it's on there. Bashan is up there in the Golan Heights, just east of the Lake of Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, called Kinnereth on the map. And they didn't have a map that had everything I wanted on it, but while you're on that map, he's going to mention three geographic regions, Bashan, Carmel, and Lebanon. Lebanon is further north up there, up past Mount Hermon. Lebanon is up in the north. The map really didn't go up quite far enough, but that's fine if you understand, you have some idea of where it is. And Carmel there, if you see Zebulun on the coast, there's a little gulf there that is formed just south of there, and Carmel is a region that kind of extended sort of south and east from that gulf, a mountainous region that was in that particular area. All three of these, however, are mentioned simply because they were very fruitful and productive places. So for God to wither the most fruitful and productive places, indicates a complete state of judgment, and this is all designed to set up the complete judgment that's going to fall on the Ninevites. So he uses Bashan, and then you got the word Carmel, K-A-R-M-E-L in the Hebrew. Again, another fertile region there, as I pointed out, towards the coast of Israel, south of the area of Zebulun. Bashan and Carmel wither, the blossoms of Lebanon wither. Same verb as we've got before, Amal, with the word Perak. P-E-R-A-C-H, and that word means a blossom, a sprout, or a bud. As plants are putting forth new growth, that's the idea. At the time when they should be prospering, when they should be flourishing, they are now withering. And then you've got the word Lebanon. L-E-B-A-N-O-N. Again, transliterated, just as our English word is. Mountains quake because of him, and the hills dissolve. Mountains is the masculine plural noun of Har, mountains, and then the verb here is the cal perfect of Rashah, R-A-S-H-A apostrophe. That word means to tremble, quake or shake. I'm doing my best Barbara Wawa. Because of him is the preposition men, and it's often used this way, although men can be used in a separative sense, like away from something or a part of something. It's also used to denote why something is done, and you have it used here in that way. Preposition men plus the third masculine singular suffix from him is equivalent to on account of him. And the hills dissolve. Definite article plus the feminine plural noun, givra. And this means a smaller mountain, or exactly that, a hill. We're familiar, G-I-B-H-R-A-H. We're familiar with the fact, not in Florida, but there are mountains and there are hills that you get smaller little geographic upheavals. And the hills dissolve. It's the hithpolel, again, equivalent to the hithpael, which is, this word is not used in the cow. This is one of the things you have to be aware of, is moog. M-U-G-H, and that means to waver or to sway back and forth, literally. Then it comes to mean to soften something up or to begin to come apart, and so they translate it, in some cases they will translate it dissolve or melt. Indicating, of course, that even the structures that you and I would think are fixed, that are solid in this world, that can be counted on, no, they're subservient to God's power as well, should he desire to use it. And again, the hithpael here are equivalent to the hithpael, the hithpolel, just a different stem, is not to be understood in a reflexive sense. They don't dissolve themselves. Normally, that is the reflexive stem. But when a stem is not used in the cal, you have the essential thing, which you have somewhat in the Greek. We call them deponent verbs because they may be passive in form, but they're still active in meaning. Like the verb erkomai, which is passive in form, but it is active in meaning. It means to come. Well, this verb is active in meaning, and actually here it's almost a passive because they're receiving the action. They're not dissolving themselves. God's dissolving them. And the hills dissolve. Again, very poetic language used here to describe functions of God's power. Indeed, the earth is upheaved by his presence. Indeed is actually the way they've translated the wow consecutive here. Again, the wow can be translated a lot of ways, depending upon how the interpreter views it. Sometimes it is clearly connective, just means and. Sometimes it's used in an adversative sense. Here they think it's used in a bit of an emphatic sense. So they translated it, indeed, again, no big deal. Indeed, the earth is upheaved, the cal imperfect of Nasa, the verb, ironically enough, the name of our space agency, means to lift up or to raise up. The earth is the definite article plus the word eretz, the earth or the land, from him, again, from his presence. Literally, you've got from his faces. Preposition men plus the word pa ne, which is almost always used. I believe it's always used in the plural. But again, that's because you don't just have one face. You have a happy face, a sad face, and, you know, different kinds of faces that you have. And from his presence could very well be translated here when he shows up or when he arrives. Not just, you can still translate it like it was before, on account of him or because of him. But the fact that they're using the word pane would typically tend to indicate an arrival of some sort. The fact that he's physically present. Again, we know that God doesn't have a face per se. God is a spirit. The world, so it is upheaved by his presence. That's the way they've translated it. His presence here rather than because of him. Or when he arrives. And the world, this is now the interesting thing here, the world, and this word here, tevel, points you to, this word actually means the inhabited part of the world is the way it's normally used, T-E-B-H-E-L. It's not talking about just the land itself, physical land, but the part of the land that's inhabited by people. And all the ones dwelling there, or in it. And all the ones dwelling in it is a wow plus the masculine singular noun construct of kol. All the ones dwelling is the kalakti participle of yashav. And this word, again, the participle indicates the ongoing nature that people live in certain regions all the time. There are certain regions that are uninhabited, we know. But here, the ones dwelling in the inhabitable areas. Who can stand before his indignation? To his faces, literally, as it were, when God shows up and he's angry and he's in a destructive mood, who is going to be able to withstand that? Before his indignation is actually to his faces. And then you have the masculine singular noun construct of Zaham. Z-A-apostrophe-A-M. This word means his, and it's got the third masculine singular suffix, to experience, or that should be or express, intense anger or indignation. So again, whether he's experiencing it, the idea, would he be here now that he's expressing it? That now he's going overt with the fact that he's ticked. Who will stand? The question is reversed. The Hebrew word order is just the opposite of the English translation here, but it expresses the same thing. Interrogative pronoun, who, and then the kal imperfect of mer, which means to stand, or amad, I'm sorry. That's a dalet. Amad means to stand or stand on one's ground. The idea here is who can withstand him when he begins to make a move. And again, the implied answer to the rhetorical question, no one. No one can. Who can endure the burning of his anger? And then will, again, the imperfect there can be understood as they've done it as potential. Who will stand before his indignation, or who can stand? Then the same question, interrogative pronoun, who will rise up? And this word to rise up can sometimes be translated to take a stand as kum, the verb, the kal imperfect again, who will or who can rise up against. And so they endure is the way they've understood this again, because you're trying to fight against something to be able to withstand it. Against is an inseparable preposition bait here, again used in an antagonistic sense. Against the karom, heat or burning. First, this means, again, a literal heat or burning, like you get with a snake bite or a fever. But most often the word is really used of intense anger. Against the anger, the heat of his nostrils. Literally, the masculine singular noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix, the heat of his nostril, which denotes his anger. Again, using these anthropomorphisms describing God in human terms. Again, the implied answer, no one. His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken up by him. Poured out is actually the main verb here, the nifal perfect of nathaq. N-A-T-H-A-Q. Oops, pardon, that's a K. It's not a Q. It's a kaf. Nathaq means to pour out, and then passively, because this is the nifal, this is the passive stem, to be poured out. Poured out like fire. I'm sorry, I skipped a word here. I've got the word anger. I missed. It's kemah. C-A-G-M-A-H. Chema is, I skipped over that word, it's the feminine singular noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix. His wrath, or his anger, they translated as wrath here, his wrath is poured out like, then he involves a simile, inseparable preposition kaf, which very often is used in the Hebrew to introduce a similitude, and is usually translated like or as. Like fire is this word, esh. E-S-H. You got the definite article. His wrath is like the fire. And the rocks are broken up by him. And the rocks is a different, slightly different word. We don't have mountains or hills now. We deal with the more fundamental aspects. Tsur. T-S-U-R. Means rocks or boulders or rocky formations. Then you got that word, same, Niphal, perfect, third masculine plural of Naphats, N-A-T-H-A-T-S. This means to break something up or to tear something down, and sometimes when used to buildings, it just means to demolish it. The idea here is, though, the word picture is, his wrath is viewed as this flaming lava river. And as it runs over these rocks, what happens? Well, they're dissolved. The formations are destroyed. They're demolished. From him, again, is on account of him or by him, just the same way it was. You got the preposition men plus the third masculine singular suffix, just like you had at the beginning of this verse. Who can stand before his indignation? Here, who can stand... I'm sorry, it was in verse 5. It was in the previous verse. Because of him is the way it's translated in the first part of verse 5. On the rocks are broken up. Again, they translated by him, but because of him. Because of his presence. All right, point one, in the previous verse, the approach of the warrior king was spoken of in terms of intense windstorms, such as hurricanes and or tornadoes, which, of course, as we know, are particularly destructive. Two, God is pictured as coming at his enemies, the objects of his wrath, in the form of a forbidding storm, with his feet kicking up dust as he approaches, again, the clouds being seen as God approaching from the regions of space in this whirlwind, in this impending natural disaster. Three, Nahum continues the thought of the approach of the warrior king, moving to the images of oceans, seas, and rivers. Four, verse 4 begins with the idea of God rebuking the sea. Nahum uses the verb ga'er, which indicates a verbal or physical check against something or someone in order to stop a particular action. Five, most often it is used of speaking to someone in an insulting way, reproving him or rebuking him. Genesis 37:10, there's a bit of, in the word itself, the way it's used, there's a bit of agitation within the word, a bit of irritation that they're expressing, even maybe possibly looking down on the person, a bit of superiority within the word itself, the verb. Genesis 37:10, he related it to his brothers and his father rebuked him. Now this is Joseph relating the dreams, the prophetic dreams that he had, to his father and brother, which indicated that he was going to be exalted within the family. Now, the dreams may seem obscure to us, but they weren't obscure to Joseph, and they weren't obscure to his family. They understood what he meant. And he says this in verse 7 when he gives the first dream, we were binding sheaves in the field, and look, my sheaf stood up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Well, they got the picture that Joseph was going to be exalted in some way, and they were going to end up subservient to him. And they understood it very clearly as they express it in verse 8, are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more. Now, they already hated Joseph because Jacob had been playing favorites in the family, which is never a wise idea when you got kids, to make one the favorite over the other. You have to treat them the same. And he had been catering at some level to Joseph because he loved Joseph more. He was the youngest child in the family. He was really a child of Jacob's old age. He was sort of what we might call an unexpected blessing. And so, as it says in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, so he made him a very colored tunic. I know, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Here, now his father, he relates another dream, and behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And his father understood the dream clearly as well, because he recognized that in the dream he was the sun, his wife would have been the moon, and the 11 stars would have been the 11 other children. He related it to him, and his father rebuked him, saying, "Look, you little idiot," essentially. I mean, that's the tone of this, is when he's dealing with Joseph here. Even though Joseph is his favorite, this is very irritating to Jacob to hear this kind of prophecy. And the fact that it was a prophecy, and this was not a conditional prophecy, this one had to be fulfilled, left Jacob very upset with Joseph. Even though Joseph had nothing to do, it's not his fault. This is the way it's going to work out in their lives. But they blame him because they assume he's trying to exalt himself. He's an arrogant little so-and-so. And his brothers already thought that about him anyway. They hated him. And he says, "What is this dream you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? Complete, as it were, worship or humiliation before you? Are you kidding me? This is never going to happen." And guess what? It happened. And by the way, God didn't let Jacob check out until he did bow down to Joseph. That was part of the reason why Jacob endured the last painful years of his life, was because he would not find, and finally he did. There we'll see at the end of Genesis, or have seen actually when we did this book, that he did bow down to him. So this word's used again with he's speaking to Joseph in a pretty stern, insulting way. Also, Jeremiah 29:27, it's used there. So he's put out with Joseph. That there's no secret there. You can kind of read that in the text and get that. But unfortunately, Joseph's dreams were true. 27 here. And now then, why have you not rebuked Jeremiah of Anathoth, who prophesies to you? For he has sent us to us in Babylon, saying, 'The exile will be long. Build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce.'" They were going to be in the Babylonian captivity 70 years. So Jeremiah sends them a prophetic word from the Lord, which this is viewed as traitorous in Israel, that you are attempting to undermine the king and the country by telling these inhabitants to settle down and get comfortable in Babylon, because they're going to be there for a while. Matter of fact, the ones he was prophesying to would die there. None of them would survive that entire captivity. So then, why haven't you put a check on him? Why haven't you told him to shut up? And essentially, that's kind of the way Jacob is speaking to Joseph back there. What, are you shut up? I don't want to hear this. So 6, when it is used in the context of a military attack, it denotes an angry battle cry shouted by a warrior, which is intended to strike fear into the hearts of his enemies and drive them away. Isaiah 30:17. So this rebuke here is the battle shout of the approaching king, who's in no mood to be trifled with at this point. People may trifle with God and get away with it from time to time over the course of their existence, but God will not be trifled with indefinitely. Verse 17, 1,000 will flee at the threat of one man. You will flee at the threat of five, until you are left as a flag on a mountaintop and as a signal on a hill. In other words, very few of you. There's not going to be much left. But the idea here, the threat is the way that word is translated there in Isaiah 30:17. Again, it's the same word, rebuke, at the rebuke of one man. But here it's just the shout of a warrior approaching that so disheartens and demoralizes the enemy that they flee. 7, there is no doubt, there is no doubt an allusion here to the specific incident of God rebuking the Red Sea so the Israelites could cross it on foot. He has demonstrated his power over the waters of the world. Psalm 106:9. Over the natural order on a number of occasions in the past. Uh, very same verb we've got here. Thus, he rebuked the Red Sea, and it dried up. Now, how did he do that? Well, he used, as we know, a natural phenomenon, a very strong east wind blowing that essentially blew the waters off of that land bridge that exists over there in the Gulf of Aqaba. And the waters were sort of held at bay by the wind, and as the Israelites crossed, and essentially because of the nature of all that, apparently the seabed had enough wind on it they walked on it like it is totally dry land. You would expect it would be kind of, I mean, if you go out in the Gulf and you've got an area of sandy beach and all that, which Nuweiba was, it was a very heavily sanded beach. You go out there and you stand in the water, and as the tide moves around, and as the waves move around, the sand will just dissolve under your feet. You'll feel it dissolving. And when they crossed the Red Sea, that didn't happen. They walked across it like it was dry land. He rebuked the Red Sea and dried it up. And then, of course, as the natural phenomena, he stopped the east wind. Once the Israelites were across and the Egyptians were in the breach, well, it was too late. They were stuck out there, and when the waters receded, or came back rather, they were done for. And they came back with a vengeance, because when that wind stopped, apparently it just let everything loose all at once. So again, there's a specific allusion to this incident, no doubt. However, point 8 in our verse, it is generalized to refer to all seas and all rivers, which God can check and cause them to dry up at his will. As we saw in the book of Revelation, the challenge there of dealing with the natural phenomena that occur, these judgments that fall, where a third of the sea is turned into blood. And essentially, for lack of a better term, if it is a natural phenomena, we're talking about a red tide outbreak, the likes of which people have not even begun to fathom. And we know what happens in red tide. And so whether it's turned into literal blood or red tide, it doesn't matter. Either way, you're going to end up with a big giant mess when a third of the seas become this way. And then he poisons the water systems of the world are poisoned. The wormwood, no doubt from the radiation of nuclear attacks that have been, and that radiation, of course, moves on the air. There's a lot of research in the book of Revelation. You can read about those things, that when those things occur, when the Soviets nuke the U.S. in a one-shot strike, essentially the Western Hemisphere is destroyed. About a fourth of the Earth is wiped out. There will be some survivors. Obviously, if you're living down there at the tip of Chile in South America, you're not going to take a direct hit. However, what will happen anyway? Well, eventually, because of the nature of the air currents and the way the wind mixes and all the things, and we don't have any idea for sure exactly how high these mushroom clouds are going to be, but assuming these warheads land within minutes of each other, which they will, there will be no retaliation on our part. There will be no fight back. We're done for. I say we won't be here. This is after the rapture. This is during Daniel's 70th week. But that all that stuff, that all the debris that's in the atmosphere and all of that, one, is going to settle back to Earth, and it's all radioactive. The vaporized remains of millions of human beings that are shot up into the atmosphere, the nuclear fallout from all of that is going to spread around the globe gradually. Some places faster than others. Again, certainly one of the things that will happen when this happens, you're going to have some massive winds created. If you've ever seen, you probably have seen some of those old things on the Discovery Channel or History Channel, and they show you when a nuclear bomb goes off, you'll see things sitting there and it'll look like everything's fine. Then suddenly it'll look like a violent wind just sweeps everything, just wipes the stage clean. Well, that's going to happen. And those winds, what all they're going to do is, again, unbelievable. So God can control the elements of the world. He can let man mess him up himself, bring on his own destruction. And then he can do anything he chooses to. And so there's going to be a lot going on. Again, it would be interesting to see and watch. But it's going to be a very, you have to be a little bit, I mean, if you like those slasher movies, you might like watching Daniel 70th week, because there's going to be a lot of blood and gore and guts. Oh my. Well, 9, in our verse, the sea and the rivers are personified as enemies, which God can easily control with a simple rebuke. The blast of his breath can dry up every source of water if he desires. And 10, as the editors of the NET Bible, the New English Translation, have observed, these phrases are particularly appropriate. Since the Assyrians waged war every spring after the Tigris and Euphrates dried up, allowing them to cross over it. And so the figure here, while it may be a little bit lost on us, the isagogics of the thing is that this was the kings of the Middle East had particular times of the year that they tended to engage in warfare. And you see that even in the Bible. There was the verse about when David gets involved with Bathsheba. It says it was at the time of the year when all the kings were out at battle. And where was David supposed to be? He was supposed to be out at battle. And he wasn't. He was back in the palace. So at that level, David was at that point out of the geographic will of God. Well, this ended up getting him into trouble, as we know. Would all these things have happened to David had he been out fighting like he should have? No. No, they wouldn't have. None of that would have occurred. But yet, God uses, again, here's the good point. God uses even our failures to advance his plan, to advance David's spiritual growth, and to bless David in the long term. Even though David, made a pretty big blunder there. Anybody that wants to try to defend David for committing adultery and killing this woman's husband's an idiot. You can't defend that. You can't say, oh, well, it was just... That's not a minor slip either. That's a pretty big blunder. That's pretty seriously. He had to really think out. I mean, the murder plot was very tortured that David had to come up with, and it didn't work out for him. And he'd go to plan A, to plan B, to plan C, and it tells you he had a plan A, plan B, and plan C. So this was a big deal. But God still managed to bless David and use him in spite of this. He wasn't done with him. So that's a good lesson on the nature of grace. So on the one hand, we're not going to condone David for what he did, but on the other hand, we're going to recognize that God used it in his life and blessed him in spite of it. So 11, as the mighty warrior par excellence, the Lord is able to deal with any watery barrier. Therefore, these watery boundaries cannot stop him from attacking Assyria. And that, to some extent, that was part of the natural defense of Nineveh, because it was located on the Tigris River. It was actually located not far from the juncture of the Tigris and the Kosar River. And this formed, at some level, one of the only few defenses that Nineveh had. I mean, their defenses were really found in the nature of their walls. The walls were the primary defense of any city during that time. And the walls of Nineveh were pretty impressive. Some suggest that they were 30 to 50 feet thick, and as much as 20 feet, 30 feet high. And so they formed a pretty formidable barrier to any invading army. But on the south and to the west, the Tigris formed a bit of a natural boundary. And in fact, they were smart enough to use this. They had one of the rivers, the Kosar, flowed literally through the city of Nineveh. And they branched it off into canals in order to provide drinking water and all of that. So even if the city was under siege, one of the problems with a siege becomes getting food and water in and out. And so you have to have a big supply of food if you're going to be besieged, and a potable supply of water. So 12 here, three particular geographic regions are mentioned, which were known to be very fertile and productive. 13, however, all relied on an adequate water supply in order to provide adequately for the luxuriant vegetation and ample forests. 14, Bashan was a region beyond the Jordan, which was known for the wild cattle in its rich pastures. Deuteronomy 32:14. Talks about the blessings of God in verse 13 that God provided for Israel. And this is a prophecy, by the way. Moses here is giving the Song of Moses is a prophecy against Israel, that they are going to reject God in spite of his goodness and that he's going to judge them. So part of that blessing is seen in verse 14, curds of cows and milk of the flock with the fat of lambs, the rams and the breed of Bashan, which apparently was one of the finest breeds of cattle out there, and goats with the finest of the wheat and the blood of grapes you drank wine. It's also seen in, it's mentioned in Ezekiel 39:18. And again, if you want to read more extensively on any of these regions, just get your concordance and look up Bashan, and it'll show you every verse in the Bible in which it is used. You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth. Now this is the call to assemble. The call to the birds of the air, the carrion birds, that are going to be called to clean up the land at some level after the slaughter of Russia. God is going to use the Soviet Union, whatever you want to call them, Russia, the Soviet Union, whoever they are nowadays, and its allies, which includes a number of nations, as we know, to engage in this shot and to take the U.S. out because of our evil. And then he's going to turn around and judge Russia, as they are foolish enough. Now it would appear, because by this time in history, Israel is pretty much alone. Whatever benefit we had been providing for them, whatever level of support and all is gone. Whatever fear that people might have about attacking Israel because of U.S. retaliation is now gone. And so therefore, having expended their nuclear arsenal, the Soviets move down on Israel into the Middle East. Now some have conjectured that they're moving there because of oil. That may be part of it, certainly. One of the intriguing things is that the Dead Sea contains very high levels of a very great natural fertilizer, potassium. And some have conjectured that because of the nature of the problems that they're going to encounter in Daniel's 70th week, that this may be a secondary motive, or maybe even the primary motive, is to get stuff in order to start growing again and to get crops to prosper. We know that the world food supply is going to suffer. That we're told early on in the book of Revelation, a quart of wheat for a denarius. In other words, basically, you can work all day, and all you'll be able to provide with your whole day's work is your living grace for that day. There will be no excess. There will still exist excess, it's just that your average person won't have it. And he says, don't touch the oil and wine, leave them alone. These are luxury items. So your high-ticket items, and you know, it's astonishing. We were watching a show the other day, or yesterday I think it was, on these first class of things you can enjoy in life, these amenities. And one of them was on the Singapore Airlines. They don't have a first class section. They have a suite section. You have your own private suite on this plane. And they pour you Dom Perignon when you get on. And you got your own bed in there. Not a seat that makes into a bed, a separate bed. And you can even get a double suite and all of that. And so the typical flight from, I think was it Tokyo or wherever it was, one of the major airports, Singapore or somewhere there, to London was about $10,000. Well, there are people who drop that without thinking about it. They're living in the type of luxury that you don't you and I probably think, well, I've never spent $10,000 on an airline ticket, but of course I never fly more than 2 hours or three in any given direction. So I suppose if you had it, so there will be people who still prosper even during Daniel's 70th week, while your average person's out there going to suffer mightily under this. They're going to prosper. So this is where he is summoning these carrion birds to come down and to clean up some of the mess where the armies of Russia, now having to use conventional warfare because there is no more nuclear arsenal. And plus, they really are wanting to pillage and plunder the land, so they're not going to want to blow it up, as it were. So they come down, and he tells them here in verse 18, "You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of princes of the earth, as though they were rams, lambs, goats, and bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan." Again, people, the idea of slaughtering a fatling, that the Soviets are set up for this slaughter because of their arrogance. It was also known for the oaks of its forest, Isaiah 2:13. So this was a very fertile and productive region. And he says, I can take the most fertile and productive region, essentially, and reduce it to a desert if I choose to. Nothing will survive if I don't want it to. Isaiah 2:13, and it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up. And here I understand it's used in a metaphorical sense because it's referring to people. Against all the oaks of Bashan. But the very fact the metaphor means anything is because the cedars of Lebanon were prized. And the oaks of Bashan were prized. And so these are the prized or famous or great people of that day. Ezekiel 27:6. It's also used there in reference to them. And this is a lament over the king of Tyre, the earthly leader. They have made all your planks of fir trees from Senir, in verse 5. Verse 6, of oaks from Bashan they have made your oars, and with ivory they have inlaid your deck of boxwood from the coastlands of Cyprus. And the idea here is that the Tyrrhenian ships were notable for their luxury and for their great construction. And also Zechariah 11:2. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar is fallen because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. And it was also known, lastly, for the beauty of its extensive plains. Isaiah 33:9. So this was quite a nice region. I mean, if you could pick a place to live in Israel, this would be a pretty rich, productive place to be. The land mourns and pines away. Lebanon is shamed and withers. Sharon is like a desert plain, and Bashan and Carmel lose their foliage. And we'll get to Carmel too. It was another place that was very well known. And then Jeremiah 50:19. And intriguingly enough, here, a prophecy. In the midst of this prophecy about prophetic Babylon, the U.S., the prophecy of the return of Israel to these productive regions. And I will bring Israel back to his pasture, and he will graze on Carmel and Bashan, and his desire will be satisfied in the hill country of Ephraim and Gilead. When Gilead was there, if you can see it on your map, it was somewhat south of Bashan. So 15, the second region that is named is Carmel, which is a term that denotes a park or orchard. In 2 Chronicles 26:10, this term is translated as fertile fields. And this is where, of course, the value of having the Hebrew, you'd never pick this up from any study of the English. You would never know it was the same term. That's 2 Chronicles 26:10. That makes a difference, I guess. He built towers in the wilderness and hewed many cisterns, for he had much livestock, both in the lowland and in the plain. He also had plowmen and vine dressers in the hill country and the fertile fields, for he loved the soil. Well, the fertile fields there is the translation of the term Carmel. And then you can also see Jeremiah 2:7, where there it's translated as fruitful land. So this is a term which denotes a park or orchard. It is a beautifully wooded mountain range running for about 13 miles southeast from the promontory on the shore of the Mediterranean in central Canaan, south on the Bay of Acre. And so there where you saw that little bay there, that inlet that comes in just south of Zebulun, that's the Bay of Acre. 16, as Easton's Bible Dictionary states, no mountain in or around Palestine retains its ancient beauty so much as Carmel. Two or three villages and some scattered cottages are found on it. Its groves are few but luxuriant. It is no place for crags and precipices or rocks of wild goats, but its surface is covered with a rich and constant foliage. And seven, essentially what he's saying is, I can take the most fruitful, productive regions of the world, and he picks the ones with which the Jews would be familiar, because primarily this prophecy is directed to them. It's about Nineveh, but it's directed to Judah. So the third region that is mentioned is that of Lebanon, which means white. The white mountain of Syria. It is the loftiest and most celebrated mountain range in Syria. 18, the scenes of Lebanon are remarkable for their grandeur and beauty, and supplied the biblical authors with many expressive similes. For instance, you see that used in Psalm 29:5. here dealing with the power of the voice of the Lord from verse 4, the voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. Yes, the Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf and Syrian like a young wild ox. It's also used in 72:16. So this region was particularly, now one of the things it was known for, the cedars of Lebanon is a phrase you will find pretty regularly in the in the Old Testament. 72:16, may there be an abundance of grain on the top of the mountains. Its fruit will wave like the cedars of Lebanon. And may those from the city flourish like vegetation of the earth. And you can also see 104:16 and 17. A 19, it was a region that was famous for its cedars, its wines, and its cool waters. Song of Solomon 5:15. It's ironic that Song of Solomon is, you know, about marital love and it's abbreviated SOS. That's ironic. 5:15 here. His legs are pillars of alabaster set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, a choice as the cedars. It's known also for its wines, Hosea 14:7. Those who live in the shadow will rise again, will raise again. And they will blossom like the vine. His renown will be like the wine of Lebanon. And its cool waters in Jeremiah 18:14. So these were very nice regions, of course, and essentially are all at the mercy of God, whether he blesses them or whether he jams them. And in this context, he's saying, I can make the fertile, most productive regions of the planet nothing. And I can do it just that fast. Does the snow of Lebanon forsake the rock of the open country? Or is the cold flowing water from a foreign land ever snatched away? And of course, as you get up into mountainous elevations where you have a good deal of snowfall, which they did in Lebanon, it's a much higher, say, in location than, say, Judah was, then you get this runoff as the snow melt occurs. And that obviously is very, very cold water. If you've ever been, I've been in Colorado, many of you probably have, but if you've been into Colorado or some of these mountainous regions where, you know, it can get pretty hot up there, even though you're high up, you may be 7,000-8,000 feet up in the air, and it's a little cooler, but it can get pretty warm, and you think, oh, that water looks nice, I'll get into it, and it's cold. It's very cold. You don't want to stay in it too terribly long. And as I learned the hard way when God was jamming me on one of my trips there, I managed to go face forward into it, not once, but twice, because I decided I knew better than God. Well, I figured out I didn't. The second time was enough, really. I mean, there is nothing like getting out of a stream with your waders completely full of water. Do you know how heavy those things are when they're completely full of water? They're heavy. And you're thinking, I've got a half a mile hike back. So you get out of them, of course, and dump the water out. You don't want to hike a half a mile with that. But yeah, those waters are cold, so you have this great situation. And of course, and it continues even into the summertime. The waters are still very cool. Well, 20. Yet these fertile, productive regions were quite dependent upon the blessing of God. When God acts in judgment, they too will suffer under the drought. And 21, the effect on these regions is expressed by the verb amel, to wither, which is used to express the state into which objects of God's punishment have fallen. Isaiah 16:8 uses this one. And this deals with a judgment on Moab. And I don't know if they've got Moab. They probably do on your land there. Yeah, they do. Moab is out there east of the Dead Sea. Moab was the descendant, of course, of Lot, the incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. Moab, that word literally means from the father. Mackenzie Phillips. So those people settled. And historically, they were not friendly to Israel. They were not friendly to Jacob. So Isaiah 16:8 deals with this judgment on Moab, and it describes it, "For the fields of Heshbon have withered, the vines of Sibmah as well. The lords of the nation have trampled down its choice clusters. When reached as far as Jazer and wandered to the deserts, its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea." And so when the judgment falls, this word withered is used to describe the state of the place afterwards. It's also used in Isaiah 19:8. Where here it's translated, "And the fishermen will lament, and those who cast a line into the Nile will mourn, and those who spread nets on the waters will pine away." There it's translated, pine away. But the idea is that the judgment has fallen and their livelihood is cut off. And the last one, Jeremiah 14:2. So these are the nature. This is the nature. It's a good word because it expresses the fact that judgment has fallen. Judah mourns and her gates languish. There it's translated as languish. They sit on the ground in mourning. The cry of Jerusalem has ascended. Their nobles have sent their servants for water. They have come to the cisterns and found no water. They have returned with their vessels empty. They have been put to shame and humiliated, and they cover their heads. And again, part of this situation isn't just the physical aspects of the judgment. It's the humiliation of judgment as God reduces people, takes them from their arrogance, and smacks them down. All right, well, our time is up, so we will stop there. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break, and we will pick up here at 5 after.